Russia says Ukraine has launched a drone strike on a train station in the western city of Kursk, leaving several people injured. Scores of Palestinians are injured as Israeli forces launched yet another raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Also coming up, officials in Canada's British Columbia have ordered the evacuation of around 30,000 people as a raging wildfire continues to spread in the country. Thanks for joining us. Ukraine is stepping up its drone strikes on Russian territory, targeting the western city of Kursk and the capital, Moscow. Local Russian officials said five people were slightly injured after a drone hit a train station in Kursk. Russia also said its air defenses jammed a Ukrainian drone flying toward Moscow. The Russian Defense Ministry said the drone crashed and left no casualties. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned last month that war was coming to Russia and that its symbolic centers and military bases were targets. The Kremlin says the escalated drone strikes have been mostly unsuccessful and look like acts of desperation. It says the attacks are motivated by Ukraine's failure to breach Russian lines during its counteroffensive to regain lost territory. Italians are grappling with record-high fuel prices after their government increased them. This month alone, the cost of petrol has reached a new record high for the 17th straight day. Max Civilli has sent us this report from Rome. He tells us how the price rise is affecting Italians' living conditions.
In Italy, August is the time when millions of people take their annual holidays. The large majority of the Italians travel to their favorite destinations with their cars. But this summer, Italians are grappling with record high fuel prices that may affect their programs, with the cost of petrol reaching a new record high for the 17th consecutive day this month.
Our lawmakers in that building over there, they are fine in their government cars paid by us citizens. Fuel costs more than 2 euros per liter today. This is pure madness. There is no reason for these hikes. It's just speculation.
According to official data, the price of fuel with standard quality reached 2.019 euros per liter on the highways earlier this week. Petrol price at some service stations has even reached 2.7 euros per liter. The last time when prices were so high was in July 2022, following the start of the war in Ukraine. The country's industry minister, Adolfo Urso, has blamed the rise in the prices of petrol and diesel to policies adopted by the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC.
Nobody here is saying that the government's version is blatantly false. OPEC doesn't have anything to do with the spike in fuel prices seen in Italy. The truth is that huge amounts of crude oil are available these days, but our country simply doesn't have the refineries to process it. Each and every proposal to invest in new refineries is thwarted by the government's adoption of green energy policies.
The EU has imposed massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia, as well as a ban on Russian oil imports over the war in Ukraine. This measure has severely affected the few refineries located in Italy. Fuel prices affect levels of consumer confidence. According to Italy's Bureau of Statistics, Istat, the country's economic morale plunged sharply in July.
This thing is slipping out of our government's control. Everything costs 30 to 40% more. At this pace, we won't be able to go anywhere in summertime.
Italy's main farmers' association, Coldiretti, has warned that in a country like Italy, where almost 90% of the goods travel by road to reach the shelves, the increase in fuel prices will result in sharp spikes, over 30%, in the cost of fruit and vegetables. Max Civilli, Rome.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli forces have wounded scores of Palestinians during a raid on the town of Beita in the West Bank city of Nablus. According to Palestine Red Crescent Society, 109 Palestinians have been injured during the clashes between Palestinians and the Israeli troops. The raid came as the regime forces are searching for a suspect in the killing of two Israelis on Saturday. No group has claimed responsibility for the operation, but Palestinian resistance movements Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have both hailed the operation as a natural response to Israeli atrocities. Tensions are high in the occupied West Bank, with Israeli forces carrying out deadly raids on Palestinian towns. Palestinians have also carried out retaliatory operations. Ashraf Shana, our correspondent, joins us from Gaza City to give us the latest on this. And we have Saad Nimr, who's a professor of political science at Birzeit University, joining us from Ramallah for an analysis. Welcome to you both. Ashraf Shana, first over to you. What do we have on the latest when it comes to this raid?
Well, a couple of Israeli forces attacked the town of Beita and injured at least 110 Palestinians, not only using rubber-coated mortar bullets, but also using tear gas canisters to inflict as much damage as possible, as much injuries as possible against Palestinian civilians. In one case, they fired multiple tear gas canisters inside the a car and almost killed the entire Palestinian family, but luckily they were rescued by members of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. The attacks against Palestinians, especially in the West Bank, are taking place on almost a daily basis, as this is part of the policies of the newly formed Israeli right wing government to try to annihilate the resistance in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds that has been increasing in recent months. Meanwhile, Palestinian resistance groups, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, said that the Palestinian resistance will not sit idle while Palestinians are being attacked. This, as they hailed yesterday's shooting operation against Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. Both resistance groups have vowed to increase the resistance as against the Israeli occupation. In recent weeks and months, we've seen an increase in Israeli military operations in the occupied West Bank as Palestinian resistance and the might of the Palestinian resistance has increased, and also the use of weapons against Israeli settlers and soldiers have increased in recent weeks and months, Kobe.
Right, Saad Nimr, I think there's a narrative that's played out that needs to be rebooted. By that, I mean the occupation itself and the different types of violations that Palestinians experience on a daily basis seems to be something that the media, along with Israelis and its backers like the U.S., want to paint as a norm. And there seems to be forgotten the fact that Palestinians are being choked because of the occupation, and therefore they retaliate. I'm not justifying violence. I'm not justifying any type of violence Palestinians perhaps are exercising. But it's a reaction to what they're experiencing. Shouldn't that part of the narrative be highlighted more often?
It's quite, you are absolutely right. It's not a justification. It's a matter of retaliation in case of a reaction to the daily Israeli atrocities. Yani, we are talking about this incident that happened on Saturday, but one day before that, we have two people were killed in Jerusalem. One of them was killed in Silwan by a settler, and the other guy died after 2 years of suffering of skull fracture during the events in 2021 near Al-Aqsa Mosque. So yani, every day we have a Palestinian who's getting killed, or many Palestinians being killed. It became on a daily basis. And apparently, the Israeli media, as well as the American media, will show these kind of things as something like normal. This is the normal life for the Palestinian. But for the Palestinian, it's not normal. It's abnormal, and it's definitely the aim behind that by the Israeli government, which they, especially Smotrich, who cleared that in his statement, saying that the Palestinians who don't like this, they can, you know, leave. Either you accept or you leave the country, otherwise we will kill you. it was quite clear. And this is a minister in the government, apart from the other ministers who are, you know, equally terrorist ministers. However, the Palestinians definitely will react to what the Israelis did. They can't expect us, you know, to stay silent with all these atrocities going on a daily basis, especially by the Israeli army as well as by the settlers. So it was a kind of a natural reaction by the Palestinians and to the Israeli atrocities. And they have to understand that. The other thing which is equally important today, that the Israeli media and the Israeli generally in Israel, they are talking about whether the Israeli army failed in preventing these kind of operations or not. And they are examining whether they were, you know, effective enough in the West Bank or not. But we can say that it's not failure or not failure. They will fail always in stopping the Palestinian resistance. They can kill, they can go to Jenin, they can kill a few there, they can go to Nablus, to Tul Karim, to Qalandia, or even to Jericho. But by the end of the day, the Palestinian resistance are escalating, not retreating. So it's not a matter of failure or not. This they have to understand. Israel have to understand that there is no people resist an occupation and fail by the end of the day. And there is no occupation will succeed always in suppressing the Palestinian the resistance. They can't. And the Palestinian resistance will continue and will escalate in the coming months.
Ashraf, you've been covering, obviously, the whole Palestinian issue for quite some time. What's your feeling on what's happening right now with this extreme cabinet? I mean, it's obvious that they have ramped up the speed at which they're going after Palestinians. The raids is one perfect example. They're encouraging the settlers to go out there. Not that they didn't do these things before, but this particular cabinet has just accelerated the pace of which it's going after Palestinians. You think that for how much longer can this be maintained? Are we on the cusp of something bigger happening? I'd like to use the word intifada, but I'm not too sure if I can, if it's reached that level. Some are saying that it's gone even beyond that level.
Well, Hamas movement has said, they didn't even say intifada, it said a revolution in the occupied West Bank. So basically, this is what Palestinian resistance factions are saying regarding what's happening in the occupied West Bank. And you have to only expect more violence by the Israeli regime, as the majority of that cabinet are extremist Jewish settlers, and at least three of them live within the occupied West Bank settlements. The Israeli regime occupied the West Bank in 1967, and for 56 years, no matter who controls Israeli government, whether it's the left, the center, or the right, their aim is to ethnically cleanse Palestinians, whether in the occupied West Bank or Al-Quds or even in the Gaza Strip.
Thank you very much for that. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Brzezet University. Ashraf Shannon, thank you so much. Our correspondent there from Gaza City. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that it has warned a U.S. helicopter carrier in the Strait of Hormuz after it was caught trying to fly choppers in the area. The commander of the IRGC's naval forces, Ali Reza Tangsiri, says the U.S. vessel was forced to ground the choppers. He says this took place with the presence of Iranian naval vessels and their warning. He made the comments in a meeting of top IRGC commanders where footage of the incident was shown. Tangsiri added that the August 17 incident was the first entry by American forces into the Persian Gulf since November 2021. Iran has time and again warned away U.S. warships for approaching its waters in the region. Tehran says foreign presence in the Persian Gulf is a security threat that should be stemmed. Tens of thousands of residents of Western Canada are under orders to evacuate their homes as raging wildfires encroach on populated areas.
The situation is highly dynamic, and the numbers are changing all of the time. But as of now, we are currently hovering at about 30,000 people on evacuation order and an additional 36,000 people on evacuation alert.
The devastating fires in British Columbia and the Northwest Territories are just the latest in a summer of dramatic wildfires across the country. Northwest Territories' capital, Yellowknife, has become a ghost town as thousands have fled the city. Western Canada has been hit with a heat wave that's fueling hundreds of out-of-control wildfires. Blazes have engulfed parts of nearly all 13 Canadian provinces and territories this year, forcing home evacuations and disrupting oil and gas production. Iran and Saudi Arabia are making further progress in strengthening ties. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Saudi Arabia on Thursday. He held talks with senior Saudi officials, including the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Amir Abdollahian described his discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. This was his first visit to the kingdom since reconciliation between the two countries earlier this year.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has paid a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Amir Abdollahian to the city of Jeddah. It was the first time a senior Iranian official met with the Saudi Crown Prince. In their meeting, both officials reviewed bilateral ties and explored future opportunities for cooperation between Tehran and Riyadh. They also discussed the latest international and regional developments. Amir Abdollahian reiterated Iran's determination to improve relations with the countries in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia play a leading role in the region and the Muslim world. He underscored the need to boost dialogue as well as development-oriented ties as the path to success in the region. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, extended his own and Saudi King's greetings to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ibrahim Raisi. Bin Salman said Saudi Arabia views the partnership with Iran as strategic. He reiterated Riyadh's invitation to the Iranian president to travel to Saudi Arabia. Before meeting Bin Salman, the top Iranian diplomat held talks with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh on Thursday. In a joint press conference, Amir Abdollahian said relations between the two countries are on the right track and progressing. Meanwhile, bin Farhan confirmed that the Saudi embassy in Tehran had resumed operations, which he described as another step in the development of relations between the two countries. The Saudi consulate in the northeastern city of Mashhad restarted its activities as well. At the end of his trip, the top Iranian diplomat said he found the Saudi authorities with a different approach than in the past, adding that the Saudis are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. In a social media post, the Iranian foreign minister hailed the discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. Amir Abdollahian's visit to Saudi Arabia was significant as it was the first time the top Iranian diplomat visited the kingdom since the signing of a Chinese brokered deal between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties in March. Tehran and Riyadh severed ties in 2016 after protests broke out in Iran over Riyadh's execution of senior cleric Nimr al-Nimr.
And that does it for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on June 11, 2023, in a meeting with a number of scientists, specialists, experts, and officials of Iran's nuclear industry. The existing scientists and experts should be used as much as possible. Their protection should be taken seriously. Anyway, respecting human resources and maintaining human resources is very important in this industry. Of course, the organization's performance in recruiting human resources and managing these resources is also important. How to manage human resources in terms of various evaluations in different aspects is also important. After all, the enemy is working in these areas, and you have seen this, and friends have tasted the enemy's blows. The enemies infiltrate places and commit acts of sabotage, which they have done, and we have all seen this. You must be very serious in taking care. Human resources are very valuable. Protect them. In evaluating them, use maximum consideration, skill, and accuracy.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There is also a recommendation about some of the challenges faced by the organization. For instance, communication with the IAEA. I strongly recommend you maintain communications with the agency. That is, maintain cooperation and interaction with the International Atomic Energy Agency, but of course, within the framework of safeguards agreements. That is, do not accept to do more than that and only do what we need to do according to the safeguards agreements. From the beginning, my recommendation to these various officials who have come and gone in this industry over the past 20 years has always been the same. I have said that you must work with the IAEA. At the same time, Parliament's laws must not be violated. This is my next recommendation. Parliament has passed a law, the Strategic Action Plan to Counter Sanctions. This law is in our interest. It is in the interest of the countries and in the interest of the nuclear industry. Some people imagine that this law is creating problems for the country. They are wrong. This law is a good law. In any case, it is a law, and the law must be obeyed. There is no room for discussion. The law must not be violated. Whether it is in gaining the access expected from you or in the information you provide, act according to this law.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
Looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid, things we have seen throughout those 4 months, may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's long-time ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid Support Forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying-wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean, like, different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube Port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus." Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "down with France" and "down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigeria's political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Nigeria's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path. The United Kingdom is hit with yet another strike action as junior doctors have launched a new walkout amid continued disputes with the government over pay and working conditions. The four-day strike began on Friday and continues until Tuesday. It includes actions by doctors just days into the medical practice. Doctors say their walkout has reached its tipping point due to the government's failure to deliver on its promises. The junior doctors demand a 35% rise, but the government says that is unrealistic and not negotiable. It is proposing a fourth of what junior doctors are asking for. The action is set to impact tens of millions of people receiving services from the National Health Service or NHS. The walkout could push only the number of appointments cancelled due to the NHS strikes past 1 million.
Pay us or lose us!
NHS officials have warned of massive disruptions as a result of the strike action taken by the junior doctors.
This latest round of junior doctors' strikes will again significantly disrupt services for patients. The additional changes this time is that organizations are unable to use agency workers to cover staff out on a strike. It is also a period of time where NHS staff often take annual leave, so there are already gaps in the workplace.
The comments by Dr. Powis comes as the number of people on waiting lists for treatment has surged to a record 7.6 million. In the past months, UK nurses, ambulance staff, and other medical workers have all joined the industrial action across the NHS, mounting more pressure on the government to address the economic woes and financial stress on the public health service workers. The four-day stoppage by junior doctors, to come as the British Medical Association, or BMA, which represents strikers, says the take-home pay of junior doctors has plunged by 26% in the last 15 years. BMA says it will continue to campaign for better pays for its members after branding the public sector pay rise announced by the government in July as insufficient. UK Health Minister Steve Barclay has remained defiant to the junior doctors' request for increased pay. Barclay insists that the pay increase is sufficient and has urged the BMA to end its strikes immediately. Barclay says a pay rise of 6% announced by the government is final. This comes as Britain has been hit hard by similar such action for the past year, with NHS staff being among the main government employees calling for higher wages and better working conditions. The most recent one was a strike staged by senior doctors on July 20 and 21. The British Medical Association said senior doctors will stage another two-day walkout on August 24th and 25th, with the industrial action expected to put the country's National Health Service under more strain.
We are, as senior doctors, really concerned about the state of the NHS, and the only way we could technically make our voices heard was to strike around something that was pay and conditions. So We've had to make ourselves come to the forefront and raise our voices about the concern we have of the NHS.
The back-to-back walkouts have already taken their toll on the country's healthcare system, prompting fears for patients' safety. Not only that, the unprecedented cost of living crisis in the UK has already impacted the Brits hard. Just to mention a few examples, an umbrella group has warned that London's housing crisis is becoming unmanageable, as 1 in 50 Londoners are now living in temporary accommodation. The group has urged the government to help low-income families. In the case of food prices, the cost of some basic items such as cheese, butter and bread has soared to more than 30% in the last 2 years, forcing poorer households to make desperate choices between keeping up with their bill payment or putting food on the table. But those are just tip of the iceberg, as the government of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is dealing with a huge economic paralysis. From raising of interest rates to curb inflation and its subsequent impact on the UK households, to a large portion of the British population being at a breaking point in dealing with their economic situation, it is not clear what lies ahead in the future for the Brits. Maybe a change in government economic policies can act as a short-term remedy to bring an end to the crisis in the UK.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters from all around the world. This is IRIB English Radio, and we are here again. I'm Vita.
Asma is here as well.
Yeah, your youth station again.
Yes, this is a new episode, which we hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, and in this episode, I want to tell you the story of my... This week.
I mean, I love the stories. I'm in love with the stories.
Yeah, I know. Especially my stories. Okay. You know, as I told you, I had a kind of mental breakdown this week that I was deciding, like, I want to change my life.
Yeah.
And I'm tired of all the things that I'm doing, these hours that I'm spending with people that don't deserve it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need a change from the root.
And I want to do something.
Yeah.
How do you come to that point that you feel, okay, I have to change everything?
I was tired. You know, this tiredness was killing me somehow. I was mentally tired, and no matter what I did, it didn't just fade away. I knew that there should be a change here.
And you start from the people around you.
Yeah, I always start from that point.
And there's a button, press it.
This is a bit selfish, I know. But this is the thing that I somehow get used to it from maybe the age of 13 or 14.
Oh, yeah.
I was like that. Whenever I wanted to change my life, I was starting from the people around me.
Yeah.
And I was starting to delete them. And this is a big world. This is a bit difficult. But, you know, sometimes there is this urge in you that you feel like you have to experience all the emotions and all the things that you've experienced in the past. And you want to rebuild them, you know.
Yeah.
And because of that, you go through the people in your life that you actually put them aside before. But now you're going to go through them again and again. And this is like a vicious cycle for you. And you get trapped in that. And this is what I do in my life.
Wow. Yeah.
This is a disaster.
So complicated.
It is. And this is a disaster for me. And because of that, whenever I want to go through change.
So simply you get tired of people.
Yeah.
Thank
because
you.
I'm such an introvert person, and when I communicate with so many people, I feel like I'm out of energy.
So it's not more of you deleting them as much as it is you try to rehash your ideas about them.
Yeah, no, I really delete them. I mean, I block them from everywhere, and I delete all of my contacts.
But I guess, you know... As in the more mature life, I suppose,
yeah.
You cannot have the ability to delete people, you know?
Maybe.
As you get older, you're going to have to deal with people the way they are.
I'm dealing with the one that I have to. I mean, I'm deleting the extra people.
So as the introvert people, they do not add new people to their lives very much easily.
Yeah, I know.
So as for myself, I would tell you that. For the friends that come into my life are not going to be deleted ever because I have picked them through a knowledge. And, I have an understanding of them and then I let them into my private zone.
I know.
Without that, they're just going to be ordinary people. I may have some greetings with them. We can smile at each other, but then they're not going to get close to me.
Yeah, I get it. So the thing I wanted to mention was that I'm going through a changing phase.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And
so
we have to go through a break too.
Yeah, at the very same time.
Yeah,
so the breaks comes in time.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
So just stay tuned, dear listeners. So, talking about this changing phase that I'm experiencing, I get to this point that maybe sometimes people just don't change.
Okay, well, now that's very tough to say a general answer to it, but I usually say to everyone when I see, you know, there is a quote that says a fool in their 40 is a fool forever.
Yeah.
So, I have another quote of my own that I say to everyone. I say that if you see a person doing a wrong thing after the age of 20, just trust me, they're going to do it forever.
Just trust me, run away.
Trust me, they're not going to change. Yeah. I know that what I'm saying is a bit harsh.
It is.
And so hard to believe and a very dangerous confession.
But let me clarify something. It's not like that they cannot change. You know, they don't want to change. You know, I mean, it's not about the capacity or capability of these people. It's about just they are the way they are and they decided to be these. But they don't want to admit that, you know. They just want to
They don't even want
to
change that, trust me.
Exactly.
You know, my cousin is a psychologist. He says that I have patients.
Yeah.
I asked him a question. I said, "Is there any chance for a person at their 40s to get healed from some
traumas,
psychological problems and traumas in their characteristics?" And then he said, "Yes, there is, but the number of the people who want to change it is very few."
Yeah, exactly. This is what I mean.
They do
not
want to change. Even if they come to admit that, okay, I'm a liar, I'm a troublemaker, I'm a vicious person, but they do not want to change it. And this is very sad.
This is sad. And, you know, there is a group of people who think like, okay, they may not change because this is something in their nature. What do you think about this mindset?
Unfortunately. Now, if I tell you, yes, it's true, would you judge me?
I want to criticize you, you know, somehow. I'm going to tell you that, for example, lying cannot be a part of your nature. I mean, you mean that you believe in that some
there
people
even,
have a
even science
nature?
Has proved that there are some characteristics that come through your genes. So heredity is going to do something.
you know?
But not everything.
I'm not saying everything. No, so but sometimes,
if there is
trust
something,
me,
you cannot change this something.
It all comes by you wishing for that thing to change. We are human beings, and yeah. God has given us this power to think, use our logic, and then has given us a heart to give us the passion and the strength to go further and change.
Yeah.
If we want to. But the thing is that not many of people would wish to change.
So you mean this wish for change is affected by the genes and this nature
thing?
No.
This wish is affected by your maturity and the much of knowledge you try to gain. But then when you do not try to change yourself, all the things that you carried that has been carried out through your genes and, you know, the nature that you have are going to just manifest themselves so wildly.
Yeah, I get it.
Some people have it in their nature to lie. Trust me.
I trust you.
I have some friends. They do not have to lie, but they lie.
They lie.
As if it's just a part of their nature.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I get it. You know, maybe 2 years ago, I was like, no, I won't believe in that. And I would say, like, no, I disagree and so on. But right now, I saw this characteristic, especially about jealousy.
Yeah.
You know, there are some people who are jealous. And, you know, this jealousy comes from their nature. You know, it's like they cannot control it. Mm-hmm. And because I saw it with my own 2 eyes that there are a group of people that really, really, these flames of the fire of jealousy are strong in them, I came to this point that maybe there are something. Maybe.
Since we have to be fair and say everything, whatever that is, against us and whatever that is for us.
Exactly.
I have to mention it in here in a barricade that even these characteristics that I claim to be in our nature might be affected by other people in our childhood, because there are some traumas that come to exist from the age of 1 to 7. That's why in this age, Imam Ali alayhi salam says you have to take care of your kids too much.
This is a really important time.
Yes. This is an important time because some traumas are going to get created just at this time.
But, you know, I have a bigger trauma here at the age of 19, that this trauma is going for breaks always when you're so, you know,
this is not a trauma. This is, I guess, a good thing because then as you cut it, you come for a new and fresh start. So you can look at it from this angle as well.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So, my optimistic girl.
Today, I've been
exactly
so optimistic. Though I had a headache and I'm still having that. Though I don't feel like so optimistic.
But you are optimistic, believe me.
Oh.
Yeah, today. I don't know what kind of miracle happened, but people change.
Yes. Yeah, that's a sign of the very fact that people can change.
Yeah, this is better and more complete. But, you know, changing is a really, really difficult
Have you ever
procedure.
Wished to change someone in your life?
Yes. Yes,
and,
there were
And
people.
Did it work?
No.
Yeah,
it
see,
didn't.
See, we come to the very fact that if someone does not wish to change, they would never change. But there have been some incidents of people who change on the spot of seeing someone who is so special. And then
it
would be just like a moment of manifestation to them. Just as they see those people, they would get enchanted by their greatness, by their, I don't know, by their features.
Charisma.
And then suddenly they start to be this different person they have never been in their life.
But, you know, I think there are some people like, you know, they're like, okay, I may change, but it's not because of you. But it's not true. Sometimes we think that we cannot change people. But you are a part of these long chains of all the people that this person will face in the future. And little by little, you, the other person, the next person, you know, you will have your own effects.
I always say it too. Because, you know, even in my among my siblings, there are some features in them that I like and I dislike.